Clubhouse.
This is Caroline.
This is Paul.
And this is Mike. Welcome to the Third Day Podcast. Tonight we're talking about episode 5 of the Third Day, Tuesday, The Daughter. This is the second episode in the Winter miniseries. As all 3 episodes are in this section, they're written by Dennis Kelly, Dino Loughlin, and Kit DeWall, and directed by Philippa Lothorpe. Stay tuned. At the end of this episode, we're going to be talking with Professor Mimir from the island, Börje Lundberg. So definitely stick around. That was a fun interview Paul and I got to do with Börje. And so you guys should definitely stick around and take a listen to that afterwards. Hey, Paul, Caroline, how you guys doing?
Fantastic. Can't complain. How are you?
Good, good. You know, I think we continue to see the mysteries unravel. I feel like we're doing really good with some of our predictions and picks. Tonight was a big info drop. Lots of information revealed to us. Lots of information revealed to the characters on the island. And a couple of surprises.
Tonight was a little more plotty than usual, in terms of needing to get all of the threads into one spot next week.
I thought it was fast in a good way. Like, by the end, I was like, whoa, that was a lot of information and a lot of, like, really quick, especially when you need certain characters to meet up with certain other characters. Sometimes shows drag that shit out for forever and ever and ever. And this was one of those, like, no way, they're actually going to be in the same place at the same time in this episode.
She's in the beach, on the beach.
Wow.
She's gonna drive by.
Right? Yeah. Like, I was impressed.
Before Autumn had even aired, we were getting ready to record episode 4. I think the 3 of us had a very specific conversation about whether or not we were really going to see Jude Law again, because he hadn't been listed in the credits for the back 3. And I believe it was Paul, the Oracle of Delphi himself, who said, you know, IMDb lies. And, you know, I'd be surprised if we didn't see Jude Law again. And motherfucker was right. Right here.
Big
the
brain
five.
On Paul. Wow.
Yeah.
That cranium held something in there, huh?
Yeah. Didn't know that he'd have those wavy locks, but
I mean, he's this is the most, this is some Prince Valiant bullshit looking hair that he's got going on here.
Oh, I thought that this was like young Colonel Sanders wig we were working
on. Oh, yeah. I mean, he's in his finest Colonel Sanders duds for sure.
Exactly. But like, but the youthful waves of a earlier Colonel Sanders.
He looked like shit. I mean, I guess he technically looked better than he did during doing the Stations of the Cross.
I recognized him, so shit, that's like steps forward.
Well, it sounds like he's doing kind of the Howard Hughes thing in The Big House, like ain't talking to no one.
Yeah. Well, wouldn't you? I'd be a little pissy
raw
up there.
I'd be kind of raw.
Right? I'd be salty after what went on at Autumn, really, right. To be honest.
I like none of you. Right. But, well, so we have really, there was actually a big information drop, though, with regards to Sam and being cooped up in the Big House. Apparently, he has access to email. And though sounds like a child and it's rambling, he was able to get an email out to Helen, which was kind of the final thing to bring her to OC. Was that a huge reveal that he had reached out to her, that he was able to send an email? And why the 14th? Because we learned that's today in the episode. It's Tuesday and it's Jess's due date. Why did he need to be off the island before her due date, do you think?
Man, I just thought all those things did collide, that there was some sort of reckoning that was going to happen when this new baby was born, and that maybe it wasn't him. What if it was Nathan? If it was this rambly thing? I don't know. If it sounds so childlike and the kid's kind of like a troublemaker, maybe he was trying to call mom to get on over here because, you know, a new heir was about to be born.
I think that's about right. Perhaps the numbers who are backing the baby, essentially. Baby backers, if you will.
Yeah.
Are greater than those that support him or Nathan or some other, you know, leader. And so all they needed was a live birth and they could take it from there. Thanks for the last 9 months.
And the awesome festival.
Right. And yeah, and the festival, but right. we're going to take our chances with the newborn.
Yeah.
Yeah, it turns out we should have gone regent route all along. We should have fucking Mr. Martin. We should have followed those instincts. But let's talk about the factions, though, because there's a whole lot of tension when this episode begins and Helen walks into the middle of this fucking debacle on the floor of the Oyster, where we learn the baby is laying sideways across her pelvis. But there's a lot of tension between Jason and Larry and kind of everyone else. It's hard to make out what the factions are. It seems Mr. and Mrs. Martin are on one side, not Team Baby. And Jason and Larry, which are doing a nice pickup from Autumn, where they are Team Jess and Team Baby. You know, there was that part where there was lots of whispering, and then Larry starts shouting about a woman on the island with something inside of her, and that was all that matters, and it was special. This was a nice pickup tonight of that theme from Autumn, which I really appreciated. Were you able to figure out any other kind of factions, and you know, besides Mr. and Mrs. Martin seemingly being anti-baby?
Me, no. I could imagine, though, that there's got to be the status quo faction. You know, not everybody on the island is going to want some form of overthrow constantly occurring, right?
Right, the non-coup group.
Right, and so, yeah, the let's just leave well enough alone crowd's got to exist. I don't know if the Martins are that crowd because they were split before.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Well, I would throw out there that the cowboy might represent a third faction that may or may not exist on the island, but at least someone who has some invested interest in how this all goes and may or may not be for Jess. We're not really sure, but he doesn't seem to be on either one of those teams conclusively.
He sure did a shit job looking for her.
Yeah.
I think his whole agenda was Helen-based.
Oh, yes.
I don't think that was a coincidence at all that he paired himself up with Helen, and he was ready to do some fucking doctor filling in that in the Seabird Motel, whether
that
she wanted to or not.
So crazy. The way he kept popping around each corner, and he was like, how did you deal with that? And then he'd pop around the beam like, and what did you do then? And it was like, oh my God, he's still asking her questions. Like, this is crazy. But first I have to ask you guys, because I want to go back to that first moment when Helen is listening to this woman screaming. Do you guys offer your help? After all that you've seen on this island, do you step forward and say, I can help? Now, Mike, you did predict Tender Hands moment was going to come back round.
Yep. I mean, we talked about that it looked like Helen and Ellie both have roles to play on the island, and that Helen's, I mean, there was all that telegraphing with Janny, right, last week's episode about her tender hands or, you know, her good tender hands. So it didn't terribly surprise me, and I think she seems like the kind of woman who is going to do the right thing, like, despite herself. You know, she wants off that fucking island after she learns that her hubby's been, you know, shacking up with someone here. And she still stops. She still goes out into the water to go get Jess when she just wants to get off the island with her girls. I think that's just who she is, or at least who we're supposed to think she is.
Do either of you guys step forward and offer up your tender hands? Or are you just out? Like, let this woman do her thing. We're getting out.
Well, before I answer that, you mentioned Ellie having some special future with the island. I definitely want to make sure that we revisit that at some point.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Her and Kale. Oh,
we are.
Oh, that will be revisited.
Revisited.
We are going into the goddamn aqueduct of this island, yes. And we are going to get down to some shit. Yes, yes, I have wood carvings. I have wall carvings all done up in my.
It is all soil or sand, Ellie. Yes. That's my impression of Kale just then. When that the is island good. Is out of balance, the whole world is out of
and
balance.
She's looking at me very severely also to add to the affect of it.
When she hands you a fish necklace tonight, Paul, be very scared.
Oh,
be very, very
worried. Scared of everything.
She's playing with a key right now.
Is that a problem? I'm going to flip it up into my hand and then slide it into my pocket real smooth. Like,
did you not see the fish head costume that she has purchased for quote-unquote Halloween time?
Be very I'm going to start worried. Snipping off the sins.
She's getting snipping evil.
Snip.
I've seen messes before and offered up my lesser skills, like, you know, my affinity with technology and stuff like that when I see people fumbling. But then also, you know, I'll have family members fumbling that I can hear just 6 feet away, and I'll just be like, beep, boop, 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 just, I'll let them go.
Yeah, you definitely let people flounder, no problem.
Until someone says, Paul, would you, oh, here it is, there's the thing. If I had, like, life-saving skills, none of my skills are life-saving. No one needs a website to save
them. Hey, now, aren't you, like, AED qualified or whatever?
They didn't have an AED.
But aren't you?
They had, like, you know, bar napkins.
Yeah, but aren't you?
Yeah, well, I was at one point.
You're certified to, like, jumpstart someone's heart.
Yes, with old technology a long time
ago. And his smoldering looks.
Yeah.
He just walks into the oyster and everyone comes alive.
Yes, right.
Ooh, I felt a jilt.
Yeah.
Paul's all clear.
Well, I mean, right. So doctors have, like, an obligation to help, right? You know, if they're able to, like, that's one of the things doctors sign up for, right? If they're able to render aid, they're supposed to. I don't know that vets... former veterinarians turned garden center employees had that same duty to call or call to action.
Well, would you, Mike, if you were there after being dicked around by this group?
He's a lawyer.
No!
Why would he? He knows all the implications and shit, you know?
I'd be sitting at the goddamn water's edge waiting for the fucking causeway to open. We would have slept in the car. We would have slept in the car at the causeway by the burnt out, you know, party shack.
Oh,
and
God.
Yeah, yeah. We would not be in the fucking oyster. I can tell you that much. If it was me.
Oh my God, that's funny.
I immediately regret this decision, ladies. Let's go. Right. Get in the car. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
very funny.
Yeah, no, I would not be.
You guys know me. I'm a sucker. I would help for sure. You know I would. I'd be all like, oh, let me help her. I would totally be Mrs. Garrett-ing it up.
And by the way, no one wants me trying to turn their fetus inside their stomach. No one wants that at all. I am as likely to, I don't know, push the baby up into her esophageal or something as to do anything else. It would look like a scene from Alien. Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. You know, and that's Spaceballs done by aliens. But nice. But I could not get over during that opening scene the idea that Helen is helping turn the baby of her, like, husband's baby mama. Yeah.
There were so many moments, you guys, where the camera would pan back and it would be having the two of them framed just so, where, like, both women were, like, either after the baby was born and they were, like, coddling it together, or they were, or the way that when, you know, she was actually working on Jess's belly, like, they had those pause moments, which we learned in Autumn. They have no problem, like, taking a beat and, like, making sure you mm-hmm. saw what you were supposed to see. And I felt like that was, like, ringing clear. Like, these two women, are you all getting it? Are you all getting it that they both have a claim on Sam?
Well, now Jess has had that change of heart. So next time they see each other, Jess is murderous, you know?
She went zero to stabby super quick at the end of the episode. But did you think before the end, when it comes up, when it becomes very obvious that she didn't know who Helen was vis-a-vis Sam, did you think there was a part of her in that opening scene that did? Because I did. I was thinking to myself, she knows who this woman is. This is all part of the mind fuck of OC. Like, turn your husband's baby. Yeah, that's it.
I know exactly what moment you're talking about, because there she was like screeching and screeching and her hair was in her face and all this stuff. Then she lays back and it's like just Helen who's like dealing with her. And the way she gazes upon Helen, there is that recognition moment where you do feel like she knows. Like, just like you said, like, yeah, you turned that baby. You know, like, it was a little weird there, but I agree, yeah.
Yeah, this fucker's going to look just like your husband. Ew. Yeah, he is, you know. And it turns out to be a girl, so hopefully not. I mean, Jude Law's an attractive man, but I don't know a great-looking woman.
You guys, on that front, were you guys surprised that it was a girl? I was super surprised it was a girl. I know we got our matriarch letter. I know we got that in Autumn, okay? So I know we got that whiff, okay? I got that. But there's other daughters around. So I was really surprised. I thought for sure this would be a boy.
It's a culture that's really invested in fathers of the island.
But yeah. Not anymore, though. It looks like that's where the shift has come, right? It was, I think, but then Sam was such a dud following Colonel Sanders' epic end on the pier. The current male Charrington line has not been super impressive.
True
so
that.
Maybe they're like, maybe we should be into women. Maybe we should be a mother, a matriarchal society. I agree. I was surprised, if not for all of the mother overtones that we've been given since the opening scenes of, you know, the fourth episode. I was surprised. I would have expected them to want a son for the island and, you know, just kind of wiping the slate clean.
Well, just because Jess had two girls and Helen had two girls, there just was a feeling that this was going to be a boy and somehow that was going to be different, I guess.
Yeah, let's talk about the statistics of that, right? I mean, this is 3 for 3 girls for Jess and 3 of 4 girls for Sam. Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, I actually happen to know a guy who has had 4 girls and no sons. Poor guy. But
What? Oh my God.
Do you know the amount of day drinking that man has to do? Oh, I mean, they're all pretty, I think the oldest one is like 11, so he still has time, but I mean, he's going to be like white haired or bald by the time all of those, all those girls will be puberty, high school age together. Come on.
Boys are not easier. Boys these days are not easier. I think there is a new crop of very sensitive boys that are no less moody than the group of girls. Maybe back in the day, boys were so like stalwart or whatever, but I'm sorry. No way. The boys have been no easier that I've known.
I was more thinking about what the girls are, when they come to a certain age, what they're doing and the boys are doing to them. That's my concern.
Oh, my God.
Not the weepiness.
There's plenty of aggressive, if you're talking sexually, there's plenty of sexually aggressive ladies out there.
I am always talking sexually, but yes.
Jess was pounced all over that, Sam. So let me just tell you, Sam did not seduce her.
Well, here's a great bookends, right? So it's the second episode of Summer that, you know, that it's the morning after their affair, and she tells him she's like Fernal Myrtle, and now it's the second episode of Winter, and she's giving birth to his daughter. I thought that was a nice kind of parallel, nice bookend to their little love story. So,
and she referred to herself in that same Fertile Myrtle-ish way when she said, like, bang on my due date, I'm like a machine and all that stuff. I actually didn't like that. For some reason, it kind of gave me the heebs. I really didn't like that when she said that. I don't know why. Because I like the actress a lot, and I like how she delivered 90% of her lines, but there was something about that line that, I don't know, it, like, made the hair stand up on my neck.
I got the distinct impression that Jess has gone round the bend by this point. This is not, this is not Summer Jess. This is not even barely Autumn Jess. This is like Kathy Bates in Misery, Jess. The island has broken her. Sam and his cold-hearted ways have broken her, I feel like. And there was a lot in that cabin. I mean, to say nothing of the stabby-stabby with Tallulah, but with the tea and the talking about it, everything about her in the back end of this episode seemed really off.
And someone's been keeping the shampoo away from her.
She got long wig. That's some hot HCG hormone wig going on there.
I mean, you don't think she's just taking really good salt and C prenatal vitamins?
Right, everybody's
just,
hair goes like
salt and soil. Salt
my
and
hair
soil.
Was like down to my waist when I was pregnant. Dirt in it. Nice.
Walking
it's for
off.
Texture. It's for texture, walking Paul.
Paul, did you like that Addie's phone call came back into play? We had talked about Chekhov's phone call, you know, and why they spent time doing it.
Yeah.
What did you think of that?
We didn't say exactly what it would be, but we thought it would be referenced later, and it was.
Oh, I think Mike said it dead on. I think he said it was Addie's phone call, because I would say maybe it was just a ping off the cell towers, but no.
Oh, was
Addie
that it?
Himself actually gave information.
The confession.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the whole thing. So, no, I think you were right on. As Jess would say, bang on.
What did you guys think of Mr. Martin's really sad attempts at lying, and then Mrs. Martin's much more convincing attempts at lying, trying to get Helen to leave Sam and leave the island?
Well, we already know that he's totally full of shit most of the time. So.
Right.
The way that he looked over, though, as to say, could you complete the lie, please, to his wife, was like...
She was more convincing, and she told probably 50% truth.
That's the trick of it, right? When you're going to tell a lie, you got to sprinkle enough truth in there to be fairly convincing, right?
You'd know.
Whoa. I'm a much better liar than Paul is. That's a fact.
That's true.
Paul's a shit liar, everyone. Yes. So if Paul tells you something, it's probably awkwardly the truth.
Yeah, but I mean, right. They always say the best lies, you know, have a foundation of truth in them, though. And I found her much more compelling. And everything about it up until the end scene sounds very plausible. Yeah, he was here and he said he was going back to you and he banged some chick and, you know, but then in 3 months he bounced. He left us all in the lurcher. That all sounded very plausible. She is an excellent liar.
And as if why they're all mad, too, that they were left in a lurch. I mean, that part was seemingly apparent to Helen, like, this place is obviously, you know, in complete like disruption right now, so something must have happened.
Well, and it's probably true, as my favorite guy Obi-Wan Kenobi would say, from a certain point of view, like, he did go away and probably he went to the house and ain't done shit after that.
That's true.
And so, yes, he went away as far as the people were concerned. He's supposed to keep the peace. He's supposed to make the sun shine and the grass grow and all that kind of stuff, apparently. And he's just not.
He's just checked out.
Yeah, let's pick up on that, because that was an interesting conversation where Jess tells Helen, the big balls on Jess says, can you go get him, Sam, from the big house?
Oh, my God.
But then she says when he looks into her eyes, then he'll get it. And she mentions the fact that they hadn't spoken in a while, so maybe 3 months is a suitable time that he has, from a certain perspective, been away. But that whole scene, the idea that he was so anti the baby, he won't even come look at it. I don't know if you guys ever watched the show Soap that aired in like the late 70s and the early 80s. What was his name? Guy from Empty Nest.
Not watched Soap in a long time, but I do know this. Richard Mulligan is who you're thinking.
Richard Mulligan, yes. Richard Mulligan would snap his fingers and cross his chest, you know, like a... And he believed that he'd become invisible whenever he did that. And the idea that he thought it so true that it was true to him. And I feel like Sam is acting like, if I don't see the baby, if I don't talk to Jess, it's not true. It's not happening. I'm not actually Colonel Sanders. I'm not in this hellhole play, you know, and it's all just in my imagination. But buddy, you got yourself a baby.
I wonder if there was something along the lines of that. You know, she's very invested in this baby and taking her rightful place, according to her, diagram. Perhaps, you know, Sam is not so invested in the place, but since he's fucked his life, that's all he's got.
I see what you're saying. So, I mean, in many ways, like by saying the baby is the queen of them all and needs to take her rightful place, that's also saying, and Nathan and Sam, they all need to be gone. And the only way he's ever seen anyone be gone before is under the chin, right?
Basically. Yep.
So, I mean, you'd be pretty freaked out about the idea that someone is staring at the heir apparent and saying, oh, good news, she's already here. You can toddle off.
These are basically the same themes as Game of Thrones, but just calmed down quite a bit.
Well,
but same stuff, same exact stuff.
Semi less fantastical. Well,
who has more guys is basically how that works out.
The island is so full of factions. I want to posit something to you that there's another faction here besides still faithful to Sam as the father, the Team Baby faction. The cowboy being maybe team island, right? I think that was kind of his whole thing was, I don't really give a shit about the affairs of man on this island. I'm here because the island replenishes me and the island, you know, can heal. And he's very island mysticism. Like, I don't think he necessarily cares about the players as much as he cares about the place. That was my vibe from him. But Let's talk about Kale and Ellie and the seduction that Kale is kind of doing to Ellie, knowing she's susceptible to the religion aspect of it all. It occurred to me that maybe there's a faction that wants to groom Ellie as the oldest daughter in the Charrington line that's alive as the heir apparent. That Tallulah should not really be Jess's worry. It's really Ellie that should be Jess's worry as the one taking the proper place if they're going to go with the matriarch. Is it possible that that's what Kale's agenda is with Ellie in this whole scene, in indoctrinating her, the rites and rituals of it all?
For sure. I mean, Caroline and I watched this episode twice, and the first time I thought it was a little odd, but then we watched it a second time where you kind of see things a little more clearer, and here Ellie's saying, so I hit a girl in the face with a rock, and then Kale says, everything soil and salt. And it's like... were you listening to what I just said?
Right, there was blood coming out of her eye. Well, you were out of balance.
Right, I committed a pretty serious crime.
She's like, cool.
The island. And it's like,
cool.
I don't know that we're all talking about the same thing here. But I think you're on to something with Ellie. It's weird that it would be Kale, because isn't she...
We think she's Jess's daughter.
I mean, she speaks with American accent, and she's blonde, and there were blonde girls before. And
yeah,
all that.
I definitely think she is.
So,
yeah, and I checked actually. Like, she's the one who's been in all the episodes too that the girls have appeared, and she's definitely the oldest Jess daughter.
So then, what is up with that?
Well, but she didn't really spend a whole lot of time with Jess, right? She was the right hand of Colonel Sanders. She was always with Colonel Sanders. She was when the when they were beating Jason during the tent revival, she was with Colonel Sanders during
I just figured he was holding them, right? I mean, that was the ransom portion of it all. Maybe Jess had to keep going to do her thing because he was hanging on to them. That's why when it happened, the children ran to Jess.
Right, but remember, just as Jess grew up in a religious cult-like society like this, the girls have now also grown up like this, too. I don't think it's far-fetched to think that Kale would throw over her mother for what she believes is best for the island. She's a true believer.
It's a total Epona Jason situation, like where the kid's going to even know, you know, better than the parents.
Yeah, I mean, I think Epona actually recognized the farsity of it all, but was still a good soldier in the end. Kale is like eyes red, this is what the island demands. Like, she, I mean, that whole scene, when she's talking to Tallulah, and she calls her a sheep, and she says the sheep gets slaughtered so we can feed, and her eyes are, like, basically flaming red. Like, really good. I actually like Freya Allen. I know her from Witcher, where she played the character Ciri in the Witcher series on Netflix. So I knew her already, and I kind of like the really intense line reading that she gives, because I think it's kind of bang on for this character on this island. She seems like she fits right in here with the Oceans.
So. She does. Her delivery of go to bed, sheepy, was right there. It was perfect.
Yeah, and one episode away from that imagery of the gutted sheep and the baby in the delivery
and that they dress Tallulah in that furry little animal zip up the whole time.
Yeah,
that has a think about it. That has a zip up through her belly like that.
Right.
Like, I mean, it is like a perfect little
sheepy.
Right up
the Nagig.
Right up the Nagig.
Right in the old Nagig. Let's talk about the Ellie Kale scene at the end, though, right? Because we have this whole seduction going on, and I don't mean seduction in a sexual way. I mean a seduction more in like a how you get grouped for a cult kind of way.
No one but you thought we meant sexually.
Well, I literally like 10 minutes ago said I always mean it sexually, so I felt like I needed to footnote like myself. But yeah, she takes her to this kind of like ancient subterranean structure that we learn was used for their secret worship when the Oceans were being persecuted for their beliefs. Their Isis beliefs, presumably. What did you guys think of just the whole setting, the vibe? This was one of my favorite sets I think I've seen in this show. And did any of the carvings on the wall jump out at you? Anything like seem very memorable for you? There's the fish chalice, and there's like the whole crucified Isis, Jesus, you know, thing on the wall. But
well, for one, she was very well prepared for this. I just met this girl today, and I'm going to take her to the secret worship place. She had multiple flashlights waiting and ready to go.
Chalices.
And she had matches for the candles. But the set itself definitely had a lot of, it gave you that feeling that it was not some ancient place, that it was an actual current use. And those etchings on the wall, all of the faces, I wish I was a better art student, because then I could maybe place that style of drawing or etching to say, yeah, these were definitely Celts or whatever. But they were all frowning, and the one that stands out to me is the one that had very detailed entrails.
Oh, my God. First of all, how many religious anythings, etchings, paintings have you seen where anyone is given like a million watt smile into the camera, like ba-bang, like everyone's always frowning.
Well, I thought it was actually a pretty nice like parallel to the church that we saw on the island, where there were some kind of classic religious renderings, right? You would see there was the first one that I think you're talking about. It almost looked like a Last Supper setting.
Yeah.
Lots of faces crowded next to each other, and there was one on the end that had like the halo, like the telltale religious halo effect. And then it was followed up by one being dissected, as they're wont to do on the island of OC. Yeah, so, and that was the kind of the same thing in the church, right? There was some, that's a religious, you know, look at the saints, okay, he beheaded her. Oh, shit, there's Jude Law, you know, with wielding double knives, you know, like, it's just like this escalation of horrors.
But never a grinning man did we see. I mean, oh my God.
A job is a job. You know, you got to get down to it. So
I appreciated that everything with Ellie and Kale. I actually think for two very young actresses, they did a great job and held their own in a lot of those scenes because really they had a great deal of screen time, just the two of them alone. And those parts with kids can drag or can feel like, oh my gosh, this is like so dramatic or so over the top. I was just as invested in conversations between the two of them as I was with Jess and Helen. So that speaks volumes to me.
Yes, I think they had a lot of screen time. They carried it a lot.
An extra shout out to Tallulah, because I also thought she did a wonderful job holding her own when she did that fuck off, Ellie. That was so awesome. I heard that so many times and I love that part. And she did a great job, her versus Jess. I mean, she had to really hold her own again in a really high intensity type scene and she sold it. So kudos to her.
The eye dart to the window, spotting out her places. Like, this is, I mean, she is straight out of, like, Orphan Annie, like, a total street hustler. Like, she'd be fine on the streets of, like, London if she had to, like, make a go of it on her own. She's, like, a total scamp, and I love Tallulah. I love her attitude. I love her vibe. I love everything about her.
Okay, I want to talk about that scampy little attitude, because I do have a question mark for you guys. There was that one scene where she obviously caught sight of a fish head on top of a slayed squirrel-ish body. And it was pretty gruesome. And mom's like, hey, are you okay? She's like, yep, I'm cool. Like, what, Lou?
Not even a jump back. Not even fucking jump back. Nothing. She's just like, yeah, that's what we call Tuesday.
Totally cool. So that makes me wonder about the darkness in old Lou, as much as I love her. But is that scampy side a little too scampy?
Well, she is 9. She mentions it. But I'm 9. Wow. There's a certain, you guys know, there's a certain age where kids don't know what's weird, you know?
That's true, yeah.
And at some point, they've seen enough and they start to know things that are weird. For instance, Caroline used to teach. And one year, I came and did some magic tricks. Yes, it is. I came and did some magic tricks for the kids and they impressed no one. And it was sad. But then then Caroline said they don't know magic from anything. It's
because they were so young. The fact that he couldn't find the quarter when it disappeared, they were like, I lose things too. And they were like, no, it's disappeared. Like, it's not here anymore. And they're like, I know, sometimes I lose my things and I can't find them. Like, they weren't not into the magic. They were just like, yes, everything's magic, isn't it, Mr. Paul? They were just like, I don't know where my food comes from. It just comes in my bowl. Like, I don't know. Like, they were just too little to appreciate it.
I think 9 is probably an age where you're starting to lose that.
I think a nine-year-old, for the most part, would recognize a mangled animal. I mean, I think that
It was a fish with legs.
Something should make
you at least jump back, at least do a double take, not like you just spotted a piece of trash on the floor. Yeah. I had the same idea. Like, man, she handled that way too well. In a way that
she's seen a lot in some way. You could look at it like she didn't know any better. Or you could look at it like she knows exactly what she's looking at and she's not weirded out at all because she's seen it a million times.
Well, what did you think of her talking so plainly about her father and drawing the parallel, drawing the parallel? Because Ellie's whole thing is your mom's favorite. That's her thing to Tallulah, right? You can get away with whatever you want. We've seen that literally since the miniseries began, the winter miniseries began. And tonight, Tallulah fires back and she's like, well, dad's a psycho and you're a psycho. And that's why he's your favorite kind of thing. She apologizes later, but she said it. It's not like something like she had thought about that before. This is a known thing she has thought about.
It kind of blows my childlike wonder theory out of
this. Doesn't it, though? Well, and not only that, though, but I have to say, I love the phrase that you're her little favor. I love that. You're her little favor. You guys, I'm going to start calling that all the time. Be like, well, you're her little favor. So what do you guys make of that? So does that mean that Sam has done so many psycho things over the years? I mean, Helen alludes to that. She said,
like 9 times she alludes to it. She's like,
put us through so much. She's drugged these girls through so much. I'm so curious as to what the F has he been doing all these years, you guys?
I mean, she rambles off like, there's loans, there's stolen money, he's fucked up in the head. Like, that's how she's introducing him to these people who she's showing his picture around, like Mr. Martin, you know? And Mr. Martin's all like, yeah, a guy looking like that, I'd remember him. Like, easy, easy, Mr.
But here's
Martin.
The thing, like, all the things she lists off were things we already knew. The stolen money, the bribe, that's all at A.
The like, loan? Knew- what loan did we know? I didn't know about a loan.
Well, as presumably he took the 40,000 pound loan to pay to Ade as the bribe. So yeah. So we knew about all of those things, but I want to know, why would Lou know shit about any of that? And yet she calls him a psycho. There's things Lou has seen and Ellie has witnessed that they've gone through that Sam has done. I want to know what those things are. That's not about finances. That's about something else.
We learned tonight, this is the bloodline of Jack the Ripper.
Oh my God.
Darkness in this fucking bloodline. Like, God knows. Lord, Jesus only knows.
Jesus!
Yeah, sweet Jesus only knows what there is lurking in the hearts of Sam and his children. Because, I'm sticking by, there is some darkness in Tallulah. There is probably some darkness in Ellie. God knows there seems to be darkness in Nathan. You know, a little bug smasher. I mean, Helen, in her therapy session, her Dr. Phil session with Cowboy, it was like, he was difficult. He was violent. He was angry. Like, yeah.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
That seems to be kind of, you know, the Jack the Ripper way of things, you know, because we had that reveal that Charrington, you know, is AKA, better known as Jackie the Ripper, which I thought was a nice fun thing because Jack the Ripper was actually never identified. You know, that's one of those cases, the ultimate cold case. Of course, it could be Charrington, you know? Why wouldn't it be? So
this is very Mad Men. What was that dude's name that everybody was hoping he would turn out to be? D.B. Cooper.
That's Cooper.
D.B. Who knew we would laugh about this one? Because I wasn't expecting to laugh about a stabby episode with
children.
Well,
this one doesn't have too much of the heavy symbolism as a lot of the other content.
It was much more... like revealing the symbolism rather than just giving us a lot of questions.
No, it was okay. We need all the chess pieces in here. We've got 1 hour left. You know, we're wrapping up this whole shebang as much as we're going to answer. So they needed to move chess. This is a classic penultimate episode, right? You got to put all of your chess pieces in place by the end of the episode. You have your one daughter in a cavern with a really intense blonde girl
that has a padlock on it. Whenever she was unlocking that padlock, I got a bad feeling in my guts. That was like, I feel like we're gonna see that door slam and that lock get clicked again, and it scares me, you guys.
I mean, I think we cannot underestimate the fact that all of the family have been separated at this point. So Helen and Jude Law are presumably together, but they're separated from their kids. The two girls are separated from each other. Everyone is defenseless in a way because they don't have any of their family
That's
around
right.
them.
Tallulah's just in the wind.
Tallulah's in the wind. I mean, she's running from Stabby Joe, Stabby Jess. You know, yeah, everyone is in some kind of danger and not near anyone else to help.
I think that's important to note.
I just want to talk some quick historical facts because you guys know I was in withdrawal. I did not have a ton of Bible stuff to look at this week. And so, you know, I was having some withdrawal.
You know, I was looking up 535 AD. I was all in it. I was all in. I was all, Paul, did you even know about this? I was like, I don't think that was the year. I was like, no, it was.
It was, right. So we knew about the Battle of Maldon from last week, right? That's when Larry tells Ellie that's where the necklace comes from, the slaughtering of the Celts at the Battle of Maldon, which, though, according to Wikipedia anyway, actually happened on the island just east of OC. Close enough. You know, I'm going to give them credit for that one. But this 535, 536 has the big weather event with the volcano thing. I thought one of the most interesting things I was reading about it was that the cultural memory of the idea of Ragnarok is credited back to this time period where there was famine across the land and the sun no longer worked, and it was seen kind of like this end of days. Some people point to the start of the Ragnarok mythology dates to this 535 weather event, 535, 536 weather event. And then in that same scene, that's where we learn about Charrington, you know, the 1888 Jack the Ripper murders.
I thought it was interesting because I think we're living through such a time that people feel like is like the worst ever, that when I was looking at 535, the way that it came up as scientists and all historians agree that that was the worst year to ever be alive. I thought that that line coming up over and over again actually felt kind of relieving to me.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay, 2020 is not so bad, you guys. I mean, they had 18 months of pure blackness, no sunshine for 18 months because of all of the volcanic everything up in the air. That actually somehow was like, I just have to put a mask on. My sun's still shining outside, okay? It weirdly felt better.
Here's the opening line from the Wikipedia page about this time period. It's the most severe and protracted short-term episode of cooling in the Northern Hemisphere in the last 2,000 years.
It's crazy. It snowed in the summer. That's so crazy.
It was repeated. The idea that OC is the soul of the world, and when it's out of whack, the world is sick. And we've heard that over again. We heard the phrase meant to be a bunch in this episode. That's kind of what Kale is getting at. That's what Larry was getting at last week when he was talking about the Battle of Malden. It always had to happen on OC because it was meant to be. Jess is talking about it was meant to be this baby. I like this idea that they are all so fatalistic, this idea of free will versus, you know, fate. They are all just so fully submitted to the idea that, you know, it's meant to be. We're just pawns in this cosmic game. Did we get an answer yet? And it's kind of driving me crazy because I don't think we have. Why is the island closed? It occurred to me that autumn, because they weren't able to have the big crowds that they wanted to be on the island during the autumn event. Because of COVID, they had to change the plans. I feel like maybe a storyline changed that was not made an edit in these episodes. But I don't understand yet why the island is closed to people. Do you guys have any sense of that?
The only thing that comes to mind right away would be witnesses, right? Or bystanders, or just people, you know, in the way. I think there's going to be some kind of conflict that's going to come here. As a result of, you know, the healthy baby being born and the factions being like, that's what we were waiting for, gear up, and something's going to happen, and they don't want anybody around for that. And some of them, like Janny, seem to figure that they're not going to make it out on the other side of whatever this conflict is.
Could be. I feel like in the scene with Cowboy, he was filling in for Helen of what happened to this island. He seemed to point it back to the festival that we all witnessed. I mean, we all got to watch the festival. Yeah, I guess they all kind of leave the island at the end of that, and then they set the guard towers on fire, and Sam and Nathan walk back into the island, and everyone else is off. But I don't know. I feel like there's a little bit of a gap there that I wish was a little clearer, because it seemed like something that started back then where they wouldn't have known about all of this coming trouble. And the cowboy says to Helen that some people want to open the island and make some coin, and others, you know, don't, you know, because they want to preserve OC the way it is. So it seems like something fundamental has shifted on the island about circling the wagons to heal the island and heal themselves versus, you know, trying to go on like business like normal.
It could be as simple as Sam just said, yeah, shut it all off. like just send out an edict from the big house. I bet that's not it. But, you know, there's a reason nobody likes him.
I mean, there's the right. There's in Clue, right, where Eileen Brennan, she's talking about, she's like, we can't have anyone coming here. You know, no one comes to the Clue house. And maybe Sam's in the same way. He's like, this place is fucked. No one comes to this island. The island is closed.
He's a total Mrs. Peacock.
He's a total Mrs. Peacock. You're a real peacock, Sam. You're a real peacock.
Oh, my gosh. There's a couple other moments that I want to make sure you mention, the cowboy and how, you know, what role that he played. And I know we talked a little bit for a second about how he was questioning Helen and trying to deal with the grief of everything with Nathan. I am still, you guys, so confused about whether Nathan is alive or dead, to be honest with you, because the way that the cowboy needs her to grieve for Nathan, even though it's been presented to us that Nathan lives in the big house, it is utterly confusing. I'm not sure what we are trying to get from that. I appreciated that they were doing this using, again, like the real world traditions and this idea of the professional mourners that he was talking about in the West Indies funeral. That's all real. And that all goes all the way back to the Bible, you guys. Apparently, you can actually see the word professional mourner. That is a real job that women had because women didn't have a way to make money.
Sounds like what my Italian grandmother used to be.
She's a professional mourner. Nice. It was interesting that they brought in that real life thing, but I'm really going to go back to that idea of like, Why? Why does Helen need to mourn? Why does the cowboy, if she's representing the island, why does she need to be sad? And especially if we, at least they're trying to present to us that Nathan is alive. So what is up with this?
I didn't think about it that way. I was more into the parallel conversation about grief that, you know, I feel like Mrs. Martin and Sam in the first episodes, the summer episodes, where Miss Martin always kept trying to get Sam to talk about his grief, but like from like a really angry standpoint, like weaponizing his grief. And I feel like the cowboy, it was an interesting kind of conversation. It was his turn to talk about grief, but with Helen. But more like really, he kept saying like fall into it. I mean, he could.
Oh,
there's
he was
some
pushing
really,
her in the chest, practically. I mean, he was really trying to get her going.
Yeah, you know, grief. It's a hole that's all around you. He tells her to fall into the hole that Nathan left behind. Like he's really getting her. He wants her to like submit to the grief, not like weaponize it, like Mrs. Martin was trying to get Sam to do, like getting him to strike out. And I thought it was an interesting kind of yin yang idea on grief. You know, should it make us? Should it spark life in us and make us even larger and act even more? Or should we just collapse inside of ourselves and just let it wash over us and consume us? I felt like that was the larger, you know, discussion on grief. Like, which one is better? Which one should you do?
But why do they need grief? There's something about this that it's almost like a, you know, like Monsters, Inc., like running the world on children's screams. Why does the island need Sam and Helen to pour out this grief, to have this suffering and everything? Why are we so, what is the balance issue here that requires these two people to just turn their soul over to grief?
I've come around, and I'm curious what Paul's take on this is. Ever since Autumn, ever since that last shot of Autumn where Nathan comes on the screen and we don't see his face, but we see he's still in the same clothes, since then I have been pretty convinced, like 99.9% convinced that he is actually dead, that he is a soul on the island, either trapped on the island or some kind of ghost figure to Sam that Sam can see. But I do not believe Nathan is actually alive. I believe that is why Goltan had to pay the ultimate price of being burned alive. I think that's why he was killed, not just for fucking up and kidnapping the kid and taking him to the island. I think it was more than that. I think Nathan is really dead because everyone else had changed. Why wouldn't the boy have changed?
Can I throw out the idea that maybe that Nathan, this is perhaps a purgatory type-ish situation that like once Helen and Sam fully grieve and actually let him go, that the whatever the hold on the island that is happening right now, that it can't breathe and it can't live and it can't do what it needs to do. Like maybe somehow Nathan's like trapped on the island or trapped somehow because his parents are holding on in a way that they haven't just let it go. They haven't grieved fully. They're still in that weird limbo. Could that be like the turmoil that the island is going through?
That why the island is sick is because they won't let go of their grief. I mean, that's a really nice literal translation of what they're talking about, and maybe would explain why Mrs. Martin and the cowboy are so obsessed with talking about their grief, about Sam and Helen's grief. Maybe Helen was lured to the island also then, if that's the idea. Maybe someone sent that email to lure her to the island.
Well, and we said it sounded so childlike, right? Like, what if it was some sort of weirdy Nathan something doing its very best to pull her over to be like, I can't leave until you freaking let me go, you know?
Hmm.
I doubt they care very much about whether or not they let them go, but maybe the idea that the island can't get better, their lives can't get back to where it is, the oyster beds can't refill until they have resolved because he's the father of the island and whatever. You know, until they let go of this grief, that's the sickness taking hold. That grief is a sickness. You know, it's something that invades inside you.
Yeah, it like erodes everything inside you, right? And until you can find a way to actually go through the full process and fully grieve, you're going to just stay in that. The song that is being played with Sam and Jess, and this whole idea that we're trying to have happiness, but even in happiness, we're still struggling and we're still kind of running away from it. And like, could this whole, I mean, if that's what it turns out to be, I mean, I think it is a really interesting parable, if you will, as a whole, to say, what if you have to let go? What if you have to live through the grief, live through these trials that Sam has to live through, do all these things to fully finally like sort of collapse into it to begin to heal. And the whole world can kind of heal as well as the island.
I think there are people who hold on to their grief specifically because it allows them to hold on to the person or the thing that they're grieving, right? And it's a very self-flagellating way of holding on to a thing by keeping it alive, because the pain stays alive, they stay alive.
Well, and we've met people where it actually becomes their identity. They're like the grieving person, but they're never past it. They never move to that next stage. That just becomes their full identity.
I mean, well, you know, the cowboy brings up the river, right? And this whole show begins with Sam going to the river. And again, rituals, rites and rituals, right? Putting one piece of clothing into the river every year. That's not letting go. If you're still doing that, fucking throw all of his clothes in the river all at once and be done with it. No, you're dragging it out. I think he says to Mr. Martin at the start of the show, he says, that's the only way we can do it. It's the only way I can do it. The only way I can, you know, let go is doing it like one piece of clothing at a time. That's a long time you're committing to letting go, you know, of that grief. Otherwise.
Well, if we're going to say it in real terms, I mean, we all have kids, so none of us could say, fucking just let them all go down the river. Like, none of us could do that.
Of course not. Of course not.
But so if we're saying it within real terms, if they're really trying to give us a message of some sort, then I appreciate that little by little he was trying to let it happen. But it seemed like it was still very, like, encapsulated. If it was one day out of the year that you have this, like, one couple moments to deal with it, that really isn't dealing with it, I guess.
Oh, he says to Jess. When he tells her about Nathan and what happened, he says, you know, I don't deal with it all the time. It's not always there. It's not always present. It's, you know, you go on, like your life goes on kind of thing. And so it's like his one time to think about the thing is like when he goes to the river. That's kind of how he made it sound.
So that really isn't really dealing with it.
No. But I thought it was interesting because the river got brought up tonight, you know, and I wanted to ask you guys. Helen says something really interesting. She says, places aren't special. Places are just places. Talking about the island, and the cowboy counters that, what about the river? And she has a really blunt answer about the river's just where a corpse was found. Are places just places, or can places be special? What do you think, Paul?
I'm kind of one of those people that's maybe like 49% convinced that the supernatural is a thing. And so I would lean toward thinking that places are special, but damn it, I sure want to see something special happen in one of those special places. But yeah, I think I could definitely see that, like haunted houses, that kind of thing, where, yeah, just strong impressions made in the whatever, the what would you call that?
The fabric of the universe.
The fabric of the universe will do in that spot, and then it affects everything henceforth. Like
a soul of the world.
Well, you were talking about the why does it have to be darkness? And I was trying to think, why would it have to be darkness? And it's perhaps maybe just the way that the island is wired into the planet is, what if it's like a battery, I guess, for darkness, and it stores it there so that the rest of the world can have lightness. You know what I mean? It's like a balance type thing. It's a very small island, I understand.
So you're saying that it keeps the bad thoughts and the grief and everything. Like, they're trying to get them to unload their grief there
and have it contained within the father of the island, if that makes sense. Like,
okay.
And he bears that burden, right?
He has to be the vessel of darkness so that there can be light other places.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of piecing together with why the focus on darkness. Wouldn't you want a balance in a person? And maybe they don't, because there was a spot in the, was it Autumn or was it this one, where someone said that they all have the darkness, but it's the fathers, that is, but it's what they do with it. And
it's the priest, right? When during Autumn, when they've pushed Sam and the boy into their respective holes that they dug,
yeah.
And he's talking about Sam and saying it's the mark of the father that they all have darkness, and some can control it, and the ones that can't control it do very, very bad things. Without remarking whether or not Sam is one of those people who does very, very bad things.
Exactly.
Intrigue.
So that's, yeah, I'm kind of thinking maybe something like that. I mean, we may never get a real explanation.
I don't know. The show has been pretty good, to be honest with you. I mean, I give them a lot of credit that they have really tried to tie things up as nicely as you can in a situation where I do think this is going to end up being like a fable or a parable or whatever, you know, that we're supposed to learn from this entire story. And in that way, there has to be some amount of like interpreting of it, right? It can't, it's not just going to have one clear ending.
That's why Nathan may never be truly revealed.
I know, which is kind of like
hallucination
getting to me.
Or,
I don't know.
Because, I mean, we know that he has mental issues.
Right.
Or but maybe that's okay, though. But maybe that's okay, though. If it's a parable, right, and you think of, like, the New Testament and all the Jesus stories, they're parables.
As I do
you
every
think
day.
About, you think about – you strike me as such. And, you know, Aesop's fables, you know. I think people interpret fables and morality stories differently because depending on your experiences, your own personal experiences and how you were raised and what your life has been like, I think all those things hit you kind of differently. And so I think whether or not Nathan is really alive or dead or a spirit is less important to be objectively true as applied to everyone versus what your own interpretation of the thing is. You know, if this is going to end up being a fable or a morality tale about grief and how we process grief, then I think whether or not he's alive or dead will be very personal to every person contemplating that.
Maybe it doesn't have to be whether the little boy is alive or dead. Maybe he just represents the motivation, whatever your motivation is that drives you to either feel grief or feel whatever. It could be a million things. It could be, you know, real deaths, or it could just be regret in general. I mean, he could embody a lot of different moments in different people's lives, because I think that this will still strike with people who are not parents or people who have no connection to kids in general or whatever. So in that way, that I do think that you could take it in and just say, like, you know, okay, that little boy represents that horrible choice I made that day, you know, and what the day I drove drunk or the day I did what, you know, whatever. He's just your regret. He's the day that you did something. For Helen is the day she said, "I wish you were never born." Her biggest regret. For Sam, it was the day he took his eyes off his son and took that phone call and he was gone. And it, for both of them, it was the day of their biggest regrets that they ever had. So that's all he has to be. And whether he's alive or not doesn't matter. But I bet you he disappears from sight once they both release this grief.
I like that. I like that. And I think that makes a lot of sense. It's, you know, it's almost like everyone's own OC would be differently. Like if someone else comes on the island of OC, they don't see a Nathan popping around the island. They see whatever their biggest regret is.
Yeah. And to your question about whether places are special, I absolutely believe places are special because, and it's different for everyone. Some places, like maybe, you know, I know a lot of people want to go to Israel. There's a lot of people who feel like there's specific places within Christianity. There's specific places maybe within your own family. A lot of people are driven to go back to wherever they think their family roots are. All those different like moments are really all played out in OC. I mean, you have the religious aspects, but you have the family history. You have a lot of things there that could stand in for basically any special place many people have. I fully believe in special places. I think they're palpable for me.
And we're getting to the end here, but, and this is a bit of a downer question, but it really struck me when Helen was talking about, and this is when, you know, Dr. Phil was really getting through to her and she breaks down. She talks about the horrible thing she said to Nathan as her last words. I think about this all the time. If these were the last words I have said to, you know, fill in the blank loved one, you know, for me, it's always Tom, right? Like whenever I had a fight and it's like the last thing I said to him before, whatever, he goes to his mother's or whatever. And I think all the time, if that was the last thing I ever said to him, fuck, how shitty I feel. Did you guys ever stop and think about like, man, that is not a good way to end the day or end the whatever, if that was the last thing I was ever going to say to someone? Is that too morbid a question for this time of night?
No, I mean, I'll speak to it for a moment. And then, Paul, you can if you want to, because it's really an us thing right at this moment in time. We're going through a family thing right this very second. And part of the thing that actually brings us a lot of comfort is that the last words that we did have with this person were great and were kind and were loving. And so I think on the flip side of that, knowing that, I think brings us a great deal of comfort right now that we wouldn't have if they had been ugly words. That's for sure. I think I can think of it invertedly and say, I think it's very important to make sure that, you know, words that you say with people are no matter how you feel, like always leave with a hug, always say something kind, no matter how angry you are, you know, because you really don't know. Is that accurate, Paul, would you say?
Yeah.
Paula.
Check mark.
It'll make my own voice be crackly if I talk too much.
To be clear, I 100% agree with you. I split custody with my son, with his mother, and there is not a night that goes by if I don't speak to him that I don't get a text before I go to sleep that says, I love you and I miss you and I'm thinking about you, because I never know. And it's something that's kind of always on my mind and something I'm always kind of thinking about. And I want to make sure the record, is not something in anger.
God forbid, whoever's listening, like I said, Paul and I are actively living this. We thought we would have another chance to say something else, and it's not fully over yet, but we won't have that chance to say something different. And we're so thankful that those last moments were really great. It really does matter. Yeah, it really does.
Oh, all right. Let's shake it off. Let's shake off the doubt.
Okay, so you guys, one thing I have to say, there's a couple moments in here that I did think were interesting, right? When Sam yells out Kaz when he's on the beach, I looked at Paul and went, oh, he calls Helen Kaz. It was her on the phone. Like, I wanted it to have been her on the phone. Way back at the beginning, I didn't want there to be like another woman or another stupid thing happening, you know?
Or like a business partner we didn't otherwise know about, you know?
Yeah.
The office manager at the garden center.
That's right. So I love that. That was awesome. The whole use of the music, again, we always are applauding Nigel for his awesome moments of dropping music. And man, Mike, that moment when, I can see it in your questions here, when the earbud pops out in the cabin and Helen recognizes the song that Jess is listening to. Oh my God. It was like mic drop. I was like, whoa, my God.
I did drop. It was a mic drop. I was like, damn. The look she gives is like.
Oh, it was like daggers out of her fucking eyes. Like, she knew. She was putting the pieces together.
She was. And then the way her face doesn't even crack a little bit when, like, literally 5 minutes later, the baby's been born. And she's like, oh, no, Jason's not the father. No, the father's name is Sam. And she has this plaster face on, like, oh, that is wonderful news. My cheeks no longer move while I speak. It was
Paul
great.
Made the best comment ever about that birth.
I said, well, I am a vet. So you're going to have to give birth the way that I'm used to seeing it happen.
Because I was like, oh, my God, she did give birth on all fours. That was like a moment of levity that we needed and all that I was like, oh, my God. You were like, she's birthed a lot of calves, I see. Because I was like, oh, my God. Which, okay, you guys, whoever's out there is like, plenty of human women give birth that way. Sure, they do. But it was just funny, the idea that a vet is like, how's about you try it this
yeah. That's really
lift
funny.
Lift your tail. What?
Helen, you don't need to stick your hand so far in. It comes to you, girl. Why don't you worry about it?
Oh my God, that was too much. Yeah.
Just that the dog days are over. It was such a shot of adrenaline when that kicks in on the soundtrack when they're trying to leave the island and all of a sudden the music comes in, but it's like It was like deja vu. It was kind of like a whiplash, but it was a real adrenaline shot. And then you realize that she's listening to it in the earbuds as she's going out into the water. And again, what a weird thing, right?
What was she trying to achieve by doing
that? Who knows? What was Sam trying to achieve when he was running towards the Ferris wheel in London. And, so what a great parallel, another great bookend that Jess pulls Sam back in from the water when he runs out into the water. And now it's Helen, Sam's husband, who saves Jess as she's going out into the water. I thought it was just a great parallel. And with the music playing, I thought added this whole other level to it, and the way it continued into the little makeshift beach house there, and the earbud pops out. The whole use of the music of that song, the Florence and the Machine song again, was so well done and orchestrated. It was a great scene. I really, really appreciate it. Great direction.
I wonder if it has anything to do with water, like the first time he's by the stream or the river. And,
yeah,
and this time she was, on the beach, running into the water.
I mean, it wouldn't be crazy that she was thinking she could give birth in the water and somehow that was going to be good or something. I don't know. I mean, it's plausible, but she was beelining it. Like, she was just going to keep walking until she was up over her head. There's no part of me that thinks she was trying to, like, kill herself or something. So, the hell? I just don't know. That was a real interesting moment. Unless you guys think, just as Jess miraculously appeared at the beachside, right when Sam popped out to just take him right into that boat to deliver him exactly where he's supposed to be, she just miraculously catches Helen's eye right as the causeway is happening here and miraculously pulls Helen back in exactly where she's going to have to go tell Sam.
I mean, I'd be more inclined to believe that if it didn't turn out to be a surprise to her. When Tallulah says, does the thing her mother said not to do and give out personal information. And when she says, we had a brother, Nathan, the air fucking sucked out of the room on the TV. It sucked out of the room where I was watching it. I could not breathe. It was the temperature noticeably dropped. The look that Jess gives, it was fantastic. It was great direction. It was great acting. And Tallulah realizes she fucked up. Everything was great about it. I loved how that entire scene played out. And then you could just see the snap in Jess's brain. And she's like, where's the knife?
Shit, the water's in the back, Lou.
Yeah.
No.
This is your phone? Gonna put it in me old pocket.
Oh my god. I thought surely she was gonna snap that in half, but
I thought for sure too. But and this is a totally silly thing. But ladies and gentlemen, if you have a brand new baby, literally minutes old, don't drink hot fucking tea over its head.
That scared the shit out of me when she said, "Ooh, it's hot." I was like, no.
Yeah. Like, what are you doing, crazy lady? You have
really
a baby
weird.
In your arms. Yeah.
That was
so
really
just a little PSA late in the thing.
Safety first, everyone. Safety first.
Well, I don't want anyone to go anywhere because we have this great interview coming up with Professor Mimir himself, Börje Lundberg. But before we say goodbye, do you guys have any final thoughts on tonight's episode?
I thought it was great. I thought that it had like a ton of information that was spewed out to us in, I thought, fucking rapid succession, which was amazing because I wanted everyone to get in position for this episode 6. And I think we're perfectly there. Paul?
I think they should have set up Ellie's rebellion a little bit more because she was pretty compliant in front of her mom the whole time. Then we find out she has this rock hitting incident, which seems more like an emotional response, whereas this going off with Kale, that just seemed like a weird instance of rebellion at a time. I mean, her mom's helping another woman give birth. This seems like a definite not screw around time.
Right.
But yeah, I disagree a little bit though, only because we knew that she had done something violent, right? I think that was revealed without the specifics. We knew by the end of last episode she had done something violent to the girls that the mother was decrying as being nasty girls. Yes, hitting with a rock is significant, but I think we knew that she had done something, and we knew that she was already kind of being ensorcelled by the religion of the island, right? The episode ends last week with her staring at the little fish necklace she had gotten from Larry, who had told her it was something special about the island and its beliefs.
And she didn't want to get in the fucking car.
right, exactly. I mean, she rebels to the mother. She's like, I don't want to leave. And she uses the excuse of the birthday weekend, but that's not what it really is. She's thinking about Kale and the promise of whatever this island secret is that no one else gets to see. No outsider gets to see. Come on, you can't hang a fucking carrot like that. Every kid is going to be interested in that, I think. But especially one who, I mean, remember, she learned that her mother lied about canceling Bible study with the grandmother, right? And she's a religious person. She has an interest in religion that her mother is trying to tamp out of her. And everyone with kids know, the more you try and tamp something out, 9 times out of 10, the kid is going to try and seek that out. So I thought they set it up pretty well. Yes, leaving her sister and walking off maybe seems a little bit out of character, but Kale is intense as fuck, man. And you could see where a young girl, this confident, girl about your same age is telling you all the stuff that you want to hear.
Oh, she was cool as fuck, you guys. She's one of those chicks that you meet on vacation that's like a townie, and you're just there with your family for a week, and she tells you there's some cool shit in this town, and you're like, I want to be your friend.
Yeah. I mean, if she was catnip for everything going on in Ellie's brain. I think if it was Larry, she would have been less likely to go. But I mean, she was hanging in there with Larry last week, right. So she is digging the Oceans. She likes it. She is picking up what they are putting down.
If she plays her cards right, she might be a messiah.
Ooh, messiah.
Fingers crossed. This is a better question than what you thought of tonight's episode. What's one question each of you would like answered? Not that we will get an answer to it, but next week's episode is called The Dark, episode 6, the final episode.
I feel pretty comfortable, actually, with the things that I've been saying about, you know, what I think this island represents, why do I think these two parents were brought here? Why do I think we need to be told this story? What are we supposed to get from it? I mean, I would love it if they would, you know, wrap this up with a bow, but I don't think we're going to exactly get that. So I don't think I have like a specific question it has to answer so much as just finish what it started here in episode 5. Just, I wanted to see this play out, the conversation between Helen and Sam, how Ellie is going to respond to this calling basically from the island. Where's Jess going to fall into all this and the new baby? Yeah, I mean, I think just finish what it's already started. I feel like my answer is halfway already been given. I just want the remainder here.
I can't pick that apart at all. I can't say where. Yeah, the rest of it's just kind of nitty gritty kind of stuff. Like, what do the little sacrificed animals mean around the island?
Oh, I have an idea about that.
How come Sheila and a gig was such a big deal last week and no one saw one this week? Is it because they cleaned them all off? Who knows?
We don't know.
I mean, Mr. Martin was busy scrubbing.
The baby was born, so maybe it's done on that nagging.
Maybe.
I have an idea about the dissected animals. So I did a little reading about Jack the Ripper tonight with this information reveal. And apparently, which is something I did not know, a lot of the victims, the canonical five anyway, I think three of the canonical five featured dissected insides. Like, their internal organs were removed. And so people began to believe that Jack the Ripper must have had some kind of medical or surgical experience because they were done with such precision. It struck me tonight that the whole ongoing theme of dissection on the island is almost like a birthright of the island, you know, that we now know descends from Jack the Ripper, that it's almost like a time-honored tradition maybe on the island of OC, that the people or some subset of the people engage in this organ removal dissection practice.
What about you, Mike? What questions do you want answered?
I think I'd like to know more definitively. I think we've gotten an idea. I think tonight we guessed about it, but I'd like to know more definitively what caused the island to shift to this mother driven savior concept after being, you know, five generations worth of patriarchal father.
The island's woke.
I guess. I mean, they got woke. I mean, Sam's contribution to the island apparently is wokeness. If after five generations of Charrington men, they're like, you know what, we're going to give the moms a chance. Like, I'd like a little more definitive, just because of the Sheila and the gigs appearing on the walls and all the places where they weren't there during autumn, even. That one, the one building we saw so much during the community dinner. You know, we saw that building a lot in that scene, and then it had a Sheila and a gig at the start of the winter episodes. So I'd like a little more information about that, like the crucified virgin, pregnant Virgin Mary, you know, all that stuff. I'd like a little bit more fill in about what caused that shift, where that faction came from. But I think we have good guesses about it. The idea that, you know, we've gave the men a shot, Jobu, so we're going to do it ourselves. You know, women doing it for themselves. So, but I'd like an answer if they're going to give one. So stay tuned now. We're going to have our interview with Borje Lundberg. And after that, we'll come back and wrap up the show. We'll be right back. Joining us now on the Third Day podcast is Mimir himself, Borje Lundberg. Borje, thank you so much for joining us all the way from Sweden. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing good. We have autumn weather here, but I guess we have seen the autumn on OC, so we are ready to go for the winter. So it's an exciting time of the year.
Autumn airing in October was very timely. It was, you know, the show producers couldn't have planned it any better to have that 12 hours air when it did.
They were lucky with the weather. It was raining a lot the days before, but it was great for the shooting and for the picture.
Before we get to autumn, and we're definitely going to talk about that 12-hour extravaganza that the show did, tell us a little bit how you got involved with the Third Day. What was the audition process like? Did you know the guys from Punch Drunk before? Talk to us about how you became Professor Mimir.
I have a Norwegian, British agent, Martin Broughton, and I've done quite a lot self-tapes for big shows the last 2 years, and I've been quite close. I felt I was ready to get a big one, and I did quite a lot of international productions. I did work in Germany, and I also felt that I have found my place on the market. I speak English, German, and French. of course, with an accent, but that's my part in the market. I'm the Scandinavian choice for English, German, and French speaking roles because I can speak quite good and I look Scandinavian, and I am Scandinavian too.
And, that's handy, yeah.
Yeah, and the strange thing is that I have done now 3 characters as a professor, but they're all very different. 2, one as an Estonian professor and one as a Danish German-speaking professor together with Alexander Fehling, you know, from Inglourious Basterds and Homeland, and this one. But I got a proposal to do a self-tape. They had chosen me. The casting director had chosen me. I felt that. So I had to sign a confidential agreement contract for the casting. And I was so sure that I could really make something out of this. I prepared for it, I think, 2-3 days. And I got support from my friend. She's an actress, Susanne Barklund. She was starring in Mamma Mia, the last one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. As Stellan Skarsgård's mother, but she's actually 5 years younger than he is. so that was. But we, you know, to do self-tapes, it's a little bit tricky. It's like baking cakes or everything. You have to find the tools and you need to practice and get the knowledge how to do it. And we're a good team. We work good together and we do quite good Saturday. Well, I did it at her place and I was thinking if they are looking for a Scandinavian guy at my age, I was thinking, who do I know that can do this better than I did? And I don't, right. Of course, know everybody, but I have quite good control over Norway and Sweden, and I couldn't really find the guy that do it better than me, maybe the same.
Sure.
But part was not big enough for our big stars like Stellan Skarsgård or Rolf Lassgård, but yeah.
Don't the Skarsgård as a family get enough roles anyway? I mean, it's time to open it up a little bit. There's Skarsgårds everywhere in America.
Yeah, I think so. You have a big point there. I agree. Totally agree.
It's time for the Lumbergs to get in on the action. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. I vote for that. So I was driving my car. It was midsummer, actually, the day after midsummer. And I got a text from my agent. Boom, boom, boom. We got a proposal. Okay. I stopped my car. That was like 3 weeks after. So I stopped my car, opened up the mail. I saw the proposal, this percentage here and buyout here and blah, 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 blah. Minimum fee in pound. And I had the script and I looked, how much am I into it and can I make it? So it took me like 4 minutes. Then I called him up and I said, go for it.
Sure.
I think it was Wednesday or something. On Thursday, Friday, I got the first 3 episodes. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to be in London on Monday. And Tuesday morning, I was sitting at Premier Studio up second floor, waiting for the director and Jude Law to do rehearsal.
That's so fast. Is it that's really fast.
It was fast. Yeah, something like that. We did a rehearsal like 2 weeks or something before we started the show. Mark likes that. Dennis Kelly was also involved. And Mark said to Joe, this is the guy we're going on. And I will show you his self-tapes later on. I don't get nervous, but I didn't sleep so well that night.
Right.
Because you want to be good. You want to really be good. And I'm not sure I was so good because it feels like it went in from one ear and out on the other side. I think we rehearsed the scene in the 3rd episode and it's a very complex scene.
Right.
And we also did rehearsal with John, Larry. So I stayed a couple of days. We had a producer dinner. I met Plan B's producers, Didi, Jeremy, HBO, Sky, producers, directors. Yeah, it was a great evening. And I stayed to Tuesday and we did a new rehearsal. Of course, during those days, I did a costume fit and makeup test and all those things. And then it took like 2 weeks or something. And we shot the first scene, which was on the pier. And it was so warm. And I had a lot of clothes. And we were standing, a group of actors. It was Mark, John, Sonera, Joe.
The scene on the pier, this is the one where the father kills himself and Jude Law enters the big house. That's a dramatic first scene to film. Wow.
It started at a really dramatic point.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Emily and Patty and Catherine, and we were standing there, and you know the scene, Jude, he comes from the boat running up to the pier. So he came. I hadn't seen him since we had the producer's dinner and the second rehearsal. So he was running from down to the boat on the pier. Mm-hmm. Then he saw me when he was running. He stopped and turned around. I was standing there together with all the other guys. He came to me, gave me a big hug and said, "When did you arrive?"
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's Jude Law. Fantastic. He sees everybody. He cares about everybody. He's one of the most generous persons I ever met. So down to earth. When you see interviews with him, he's a charming guy, smiling. He is that. He sees everybody. He's fantastic. As an actor, of course, but as a person.
When you read the script, what was your reaction to this show? I don't think I've ever seen a show like this. It's so avant-garde and theater-like. It's really... I don't want to say trippy, but it's bizarre. And I can't imagine reading the words on the page. Did you have a good idea of what you were even reading while you were reading it as you were going through the script?
Not really from the beginning, because not the first time, because it's not my native language. And you need to read it maybe 2-3 times so you really start to understand how much is hidden in the script. There are so many things to discover about the props and the actors and the groups on the island and the characters. So, by and by, but not from first reading. That was more to get a summary of the total, what is this is about. But when you see it in picture, it's something else. You have sound and everything, but when you read and start with the script, you need to read it 3-4 times to really get into it. I was very much concentrated to find my character and the scenes I was into.
Did you recognize the parallels with your character and his namesake Norse mythology person?
No, I understood that later. This Mimir is a Norse name. He was some kind of god. So what I felt from the beginning was that I could be different to the people on the island, because I was not born there. I was not born there.
Okay.
Like Sherrington and the others. I mean, I feel like Larry and Jason, they are born there. They're grown up there. But I was probably not born there. So I could go against people a little bit more, because I didn't have my blood coming from OC. That's what I felt.
Mimir definitely seems to have been treated with kind of an outsider vibe, especially in the first 3 episodes. You know, the Larry and Jason and their little gang of, you know, they're kind of beating up on you and threatening you. So not being born on the island makes a lot of sense with the way they seem to treat outsiders.
Yeah, I know those islands we have in Sweden. I think many coasts, there are these kind of islands with very heavy religion and tradition, and they are people are, all of them are living there. They are related somehow. They're married to cousins and like that. And I was running a hotel in that kind of area when I was very young. And I know the religion can be very, very heavy and have a big impact on people. And they also sometimes have drinkers. So the Usi culture you can find on islands around the Swedish coast, in Norwegian too, I guess.
So that's interesting. You had that kind of experience before coming to the show to kind of give a real life parallel to a you know, a sequestered or a separate group of people pursuing their own version of religion. And their treatment toward outsiders when they get in the middle of, you know, rites and ceremonies and that sort of stuff.
I think it's only you live on an island, grow up in that kind of community, it's very difficult to go against people. You don't do it.
How did Mark and Dennis, how did they describe the character of Mimir to you? Like, did they give you much of a backstory for him, or did you kind of create one in your head as the filming went on?
I told Mark the first meeting that I recognize this kind of, as I just described now, this kind of island with this religion and how people are, and they live, they have their own society, their own rules, and I feel I recognize it. And I didn't have so much to ask about that. It was more how to play the scene with Jude in the second and the third episode. Those are very technical scenes. I mean, it's not a reaction on a dialogue. That's very easy. If you say something, I react on that, and I say something, you react on that. This is more minimalistic. It's not so concrete, I would say.
Yeah, your first appearance on screen is almost entirely just acting with your face and not a lot of words.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are no lines. I need to know what shall I take out from my inside. That's what we talk about. I really like that kind of playing. I don't need lines.
You don't need lines. Yeah, so the drawing on the inside, you know, the emotional acting.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you have seen a Man Called Ove. It was Academy Award nominated 2016. I think it was the most seen foreign film in USA that year. Tom Hanks was supposed to do a remake, and and I play with my face mostly in that. Yeah. I like that.
Just picking up on what you said, you know, your interactions with Jude in the second and third episode, the Mimir in mythology is known for his wisdom and his knowledge, and he is an advisor. Yes. He's kind of like, he's a guide to Odin. And in those two interactions with Sam, you give him important information. One, him just going through your office in the second episode, but then in the third one, you explain to him that he's now been inducted into the cult. He's been baptized. And those are really important interactions for Sam to kind of get a handle on what's happening on OC and his role in it. We haven't seen that yet with Helen. Without being too spoiler, can you say if you're going to have a similar role with her at all before this is all said and done?
No, not she and I, no.
Okay.
Between the first three and the last three, OC is a pretty different looking, different place in winter than it was in summer. And I guess the directors that they used to determine those kinds of looks and feels and all that kind of stuff, they changed between the first three and the last three. Were there any differences as an actor between preparing for the first three and the last three?
Similar and not similar. Mark likes to rehearse, and Philippa says, with a good actors, I don't need to rehearse. So, yeah. But they work very much. They give confidence. They expect the actors to have a proposal how to play the scenes. And here also, the writers are involved, and the producers are following it closely. So I would say it's a team working with the, also, so I'm involved with the scenes when we shoot them. There are a lot of smart people around, and I think it's very important for them to hold the storyline and not to repeat things. Jude is the same. He said, no, we have to have this. We have said that before. I mean, it's very, very clever, fantastic people around. For me, it was more concentrate to what they... I worked with my scenes, and I gave my proposals. I was very well prepared when it was my time for the shooting. would say.
I think the style of the show is different between summer and winter, but specifically your character is different between summer and winter. One, I mean, you're kind of fully awake and not drunk, which I don't think we've seen a bottle of wine in your hand yet in the winter episodes. When this interview comes out, people will have seen episodes 4 and 5. So Mimir seems much more involved in the island politics. Can you talk a little bit about the changes in your character between the two segments? And if you can, what your involvement is with OC and the pregnancy storyline in the winter half?
Yeah. Mimir, he got some help probably with his drinking issues. So we will see if he continues on this line with be sober. But he comes up, he has changed, he's become sober, more sharp, and is more involved in the entire community and what goes on. And he knows who he wants to see as the father for OC and who he trusts and likes.
That's a big important plot point in the last half, is what team you're on, for sure.
Yeah, because the question is, what's going to happen to OC?
There seems like there was a bit of a shakeup, though, in the island politics. So when we see in episode 4... Helen and her girls are hiding in the kind of makeshift OBGYN office, the pregnancy shack. And we see Mimir and Jason and the preacher show up. And those are three people who didn't necessarily all kind of interact and get along in the first half. But now they kind of seem to have teamed up with each other, you know, presumably against another faction on the island. Will there be more development for Mimir and what the factions stand for? Will it be clearer to us what the dividing line is between the islands now?
Yeah, by and by.
Yeah. You're being very cagey, but close to the vest. No spoilers from Boyer.
It will clear up a lot, I would say. He gave out 5 episodes to the critics, but they didn't like that they were not able to see this. The last ones.
Yes, I was not happy about it either. I'm sitting here waiting for 6 to hit my inbox.
Yeah.
They're so tricky, the HBO guys.
Yeah, but this is a tricky story. Tricky story. It really is.
So we didn't see Mimir during the autumn recording.
No.
Do you know what Mimir was
doing? I was back here.
Oh, were you supposed to be there?
Well, there were talks in the springtime, but you know, they came up with this corona, and I mean, if I go there, I had to go there, I would be in quarantine for 2 weeks and before, and this autumn was supposed to be thousands of people on the island, real festival and something very different from the beginning. They had to make it, do it after the rules for the COVID-19. The plan was a big, big festival with a lot of viewers.
In some ways, though, I think it was even kind of more haunting, though, with less people on the island. It seemed spookier in some ways.
Yeah.
What did you think of it as far as an event goes? As a viewer, what did you think of it?
First, I'm thinking, okay, I will see if I watch 30 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours. I mean, I know the island. I know lots of the people. And the thing is, I watch it on my computer, and I took a break for 20 minutes. I did some cooking, and then I had the computer with me in the kitchen. So I watched it all the 12 hours. I couldn't go away.
It was hypnotic. It was hard to turn away from it.
Yeah, and this is true. I was there. I never watched a show like this. I mean, in time, normally I watch 2-3 episodes maybe for one evening, and then I take the rest next day. That's 2-3 hours. Now I watch 12 hours, and I couldn't go away. I was there watching every minute. I couldn't. I was stuck. Wow, it was amazing. And I'm not sure what it was that kept me watching all the time, but I couldn't go away. Was there?
It seemed like a lot of viewers that were chiming in on the Facebook chat feed and I was paying attention to Twitter, said pretty much the same thing. They knew that they were going to watch Jude Law dig a very deep hole all by himself for a long time, but they couldn't stop watching.
No.
You know, watching him to dig the hole or watching him up on that platform, not moving for, 15 minutes when he eventually falls in the water. I felt like I was invested. Like there was payoff for there because I watched him stand there for 15 minutes. If I had just been fast forwarding and then he fell in the water or something like that, I wouldn't have cared as much, watching it. I was going through the struggles with him, the rave at the end, the mud baptisms, all that stuff. You kind of felt like you were there because you were there for so long. You went through every minute of it with them.
I mean, I didn't like all parts. Some I liked more, some less, but I couldn't go away.
Right. I think we had the same reaction. There were a couple of parts that, we were like, oh, when is this going to, be over a little bit? I don't want to speak for Paul, but I know the rave scene at the end got a little long, with all the music and stuff. But you also, because you never knew when something was going to happen, though, so you didn't really want to look away either. Did the cast know what was going to happen, or at least the big parts of what had to happen during autumn as far as the whole story goes? Because it does connect summer to winter a bit. I mean, there are some questions in winter that are not yet answered, but there's definitely it's definitely a connector piece. Did you guys know what was supposed to happen in autumn over the 12 hours?
We were not informed, but there was some talks about what would happen with Jude. But I think this rewrote with this after the decision about the COVID and everything, and so we didn't know. We didn't took any care. We were not informed when we shot the summer or the winter. No, and we didn't we were not informed that this and this and this has happened. No, we got these six episodes.
What do you think Mimir was doing during the Isis and the Sea Festival? Because him and the Martins weren't there. We didn't see Patty or Emily either on the island. So I like to think the three of them were hanging out together somewhere.
Yeah. I think he would hang together with Jess.
With Jess?
Oh, with Jess, sure.
Yeah, because she was also not born on the island, and there is some connection with them. They are a little bit outsiders, and I think he liked her.
I met you in the Facebook group for the show, and there's been a lot of activity in that Facebook group. What's your experience been like interacting with fans, talking about the show? Has it been positive? Have you enjoyed the interaction?
It's interesting. I was curious to see how people discuss. I mean, those in the group are very, they have not a lot of knowledge, and they are very much into the show and knows a lot and have a lot of good thinking and good ideas and the questions and everything. So it's very interesting to see how their enthusiasm for the show and see what they write. And it's very interesting because I'm too much in. Yeah, I'm part of the game, and they are also, but not this, on the same way. So it's very interesting to see what they think about different scenes and the story. And it's interesting, very interesting.
Have you ever worked on a project that's had that kind of trigger for people before? Is this kind of a new experience for you, or at least with an American audience anyway?
No, it's a new experience. We had this feature film, Midsummer. I had friends involved in that one.
Oh, okay.
But that's a feature film. It's not the same as a series, and we don't do those series in Sweden. We more and more we cooperate with other countries and develop series, because we are a small country. We need bigger money, bigger markets. We do more smaller budget for series. Easier somehow. I think it's very difficult if you call this a horror series. It's very difficult to do in Syria, because it's like commercial. When you have the twist, it's over. You build up the platform and you have the twist and the commercial and it's over. Sometimes with the horror is the same. When the threat shows up and you see the face from the threat, somehow it's over. So it fits very well for a feature film. You can do it like here in Syria, but it takes so, you had to work so hard to get work all the way. I mean, it's much more easier with the romantic drama. It goes up and down. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. That's why they it's amazing that they can do those 6 episodes. We are compared to The Wicker Man and Midsommar, but those are not serious. Those are feature films.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And here you have 6 plus The Autumn, 12 hours. So, and still the drama is there.
Yeah, it never lets up. Yeah, right. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, the fact like the music helps a lot to the, especially in the 12 hours, the music was so constant and so mood setting.
Yeah.
You never really feel like you can breathe when you're watching the show. And it's, you know, it's by said and done, it's going to be, you know, 18 hours worth of this OC Island, this madness. And it's been an experience. I don't know that I've ever, I watch a lot of TV. I don't know that I've ever had any kind of experience like watching The Third Day.
That's what I try to say.
Boryeh, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate taking the time and chatting with us all about Mimir and the show. Anything else you want to say before we head out? Anything we should know? Anything you're working on? I don't know what the Sweden film industry looks like right now.
Well, I do mostly international productions, and I hope that everything will open up, and the Skarsgårds are very clever, but they are more clever people doing that. So I won't say.
So funny.
And you take care and stay safe. That's the most important thing now. I have changed since April. I've lost 14 kilo. I exercise. I've been running, exercising almost every day for 5-6 months. And I started horse riding. So I changed my character to be big stomach, to be fit, to a fit Viking. That's my new character.
Nice.
That's it. You're going to play
Professor,
Mimir.
Professor Viking.
You're going to play Mimir for real. You're trying out for the next Thor movie or something, maybe. So something. We're going to see you in the we'll tell Marvel to give you a call. Maybe you can get into the Thor movies. So,
no problem.
Take
care. Stay safe.
Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
A big thank you to Boryeh Lundberg for being our guest on tonight's episode. I think it was a really fun conversation. I really liked slamming on the Skarsgårds. I like the idea that he is our go-to bilingual Swedish actor for all roles in his age range. Yeah, just a big shout out for, you know, spending his time with us and talking, you know, talking probably way longer than he had planned on it. So thank you to Professor Mimir himself, Boryeh Lundberg, for spending time.
It was fun.
Thanks you to all of our listeners. We are popping up in Great Britain all over the place, and that is amazing. And thank you guys so much for listening. This is Caroline.
This is Paul.
And this is Mike. Thanks for listening to the Third Day podcast. Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.
Pod Clubhouse.